Welcome to Life Quest Liberty, live in-depth conversations with today's top writers, editors, and spiritual leaders concerning religious freedom around the world. On today's broadcast, we'll examine local and international factors that may be impacting your right to worship and obey God as your conscience dictates. I'm your Life Quest Liberty host, Charles Mills. If you're a subscriber to Liberty Magazine, you know it arrives regularly in your mailbox, and then you can sit down and enjoy the articles, artwork, and message of this world-class publication. But have you ever wondered just how Liberty makes that journey, how it becomes the magazine you read? Let's ask Lincoln Steed, editor of Liberty Magazine, for a behind-the-scenes look at how Liberty becomes Liberty. Lincoln, the production of the magazine, any magazine, has certainly changed over a lifetime. Have you ever thought about what it was like to make Liberty Magazine 100 and so years ago when it first started?
Absolutely. And while you were introducing the magazine, I was thinking of a very interesting illustration of that. Liberty for, it's about 105 years now since it was begun. And it was printed always at the Review and Herald Publishing Association, which is now in Hagerstown, Maryland. But a few years ago, it was in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And before that, way back when Liberty Magazine was first begun, it was in a little printing establishment not very far from the Capitol, and in fact in a park just next to it. I remember once we found the spot, it's just out under the trees there, and there's a plaque commemorating something else, and that's where the publishing house was. And Liberty was printed there. And I had a good reminder of those humble origins not too long ago when someone who was researching an article on this for me came into my office and almost threw on my desk a pile of incredibly old-looking, weathered, yellowed, and brittle copies of an early publication of Liberty Magazine. And you know what where he got them from? The old Review and Herald Publishing House, which moved only, I think it was 5 or 6 years after the downtown establishment, they moved to the new spot. And obviously they took the equipment and everything from the first spot. And they used leftover Liberty magazines as well as other things for insulation in the roof. It piled up all
that. I like that. There's meaning there, I think. Absolutely.
Yeah. So just a few years ago, the property was sold because the General Conference is now in Silver Spring.
And
the Review and Herald used to be at the old General Conference location. And so after it was sold, someone went up into the roof because they had an asbestos problem. And they were looking around and they found all of these papers up there.
That's
you know, I don't know if how many people know, you can insulate your ceiling with fiberglass, but an awful lot of homes have basically ground up paper.
Sure, newspapers.
Trying to think of sort of without water, if it had water, it would be paper mache. Fluffy ground up newspaper. Yeah. So it's a good insulator.
Yeah.
But it was amazing to see these early issues from the beginning of the century. But, you know, I work with Liberty Magazine, and I've worked with other magazines and other periodicals and books, textbooks, as well as so-called trade books that are sold to the general public. So I know how printing is run, and it's a rather complicated procedure. Most people don't realize it has changed. It has modernized progressively over the years, but some elements of it have changed extremely little. Like one element that I do, even part of it, is proofing. Reading the proofs, we call it. Once you start to put the pages together, initially from just choosing a typeface and run out on sheets, you read that. Then it becomes more integrated with the pictures and the frills that make up a typical page. They have to be read. They have to be checked several times, not just by the editor, but we have proofreaders. We have copy editors who check all the facts. People sometimes wonder about a magazine, or maybe they don't wonder, but people get magazines and books and they read it and they take it as fact, unless it's maybe a newspapery colored sort of a garish thing on the newsstands that tells you about the lives of the stars. They probably don't hold that to the same standard, but most people presume something that they buy in the public forum is accurate. Well, it's only accurate when an effort's made to see that it is. And we bring experts to bear on the articles, but even when they send it in, somebody will check every fact. When someone says such and such happened on such a date or such and such a court case, and they quote from it, mm-hmm. someone makes an effort to check that out, to run it back to the basic source. And if they can't, they'll query or put a notation on the proof to me. Can't find this. Mm-hmm. Doesn't seem accurate. Mm-hmm. So that's an important part of the process of preparing a magazine to be authoritative, to catch the attention and gain the trust of the readers.
Now, the people who write for you, who send in the articles, what type of people? Are we talking about professors at law schools? What type of person writes for you?
Well, some of them are.
Yeah.
It's a pretty wide variety. I remember once I had a contact or a way of getting through, and I assigned then-Governor Huckabee of Arkansas mm-hmm. to do an article on education and the principle of separation of church and state. So he wrote that article, very happy to do it. Other times we get law professors, other times lawyers or people that have some direct involvement in a religious liberty case. We've had ministers write articles. We have historians. We don't restrict, though. If somebody is motivated to write an article for Liberty Magazine, you know, if they write it up ahead of time, fine. Otherwise, it's probably safer for them to run a query, you know, say, if I did an article on such and such. And then usually it's a matter of what qualifications do you have, what do you know, mm-hmm. and I'd make judgments based even on their letter.
Mm.
I used to tell people in writing classes, you could tell an awful lot from someone's proposal letter about how they can write. Even an email, you can tell if someone can put a thought together. Although it's probably not good to judge from an email, because especially Twitter-type thinking,
yes,
people can contract and omit even the basic rules of grammar. But you certainly can tell from a cover letter, and where I developed the theory on that is I used to be book editor at a big publishing house, mm-hmm. and I got hundreds, maybe thousands of book manuscripts in a year. And it'll probably disillusion some people to think so, but any number of them, I made my decision based on the cover letter without even seeing the manuscript.
Yeah.
I could tell they couldn't put two words together. You know, a few times that the subject might have interested me, even if their letter was bad, I found that it tracked pretty true.
Mm-hmm.
That if they could write, the letter read well. If they couldn't write, the letter was bad, so would the manuscript be.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a whole wider range of people. We tend to rely on some repeat offenders. but we have a wide range. I didn't realize how wide it was until recently my associate, Melissa Reed, who keeps a closer watch on our website than I do, came up with an idea that we have a sort of a round table blog site. Where
I saw that. That's interesting stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So where she started from was she went looking at our past authors.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't realized what a diverse group we have. And I can't think of anybody that said no. So all the ones that we asked agreed to regularly contribute blogs to our round table blog site.
Mm-hmm. I think that goes for passion, because if they wrote for Liberty Magazine, they have to have the passion for the subject matter, and people with passion tend to like to be involved. And you mentioned Huckabee and other writers, but they all go through the same scrutiny. The copy editors look at each
absolutely.
One equally, right? You don't just believe it because they wrote it, and they're someone important.
No.
Yeah, okay.
And I probably got an enemy out there somewhere, but I remember an assistant to a governor of one state called me up once, wanted an article put in, and they sent me the article in the end. But when I read it, it was so partisan, I thought, I'm not going to put it in.
Mm-hmm.
And so just because someone important wants it doesn't automatically mean it goes in.
Okay.
And Liberty Magazine does try, well, more than try, we're committed to being nonpartisan.
Yeah.
Some of our own church members don't quite understand what we're doing with religious liberty, because they see a lot of political talk, but you cannot help but talk and even make judgments about political issues.
Yeah.
But that's not culpable as far as the IRS is concerned, not out of sync with our views on religious liberty. It's absolutely okay, but we cannot be partisan. We're not dedicated to one party or the other. We're certainly not beholden to any party whatsoever.
Right.
We don't try to offend them either,
yeah,
gratuitously, but if it's necessary, we will.
anyone who has been a regular subscriber to Liberty Magazine has really come to appreciate the artwork in there. Amazing photography, amazing artwork in there.
I'm one of them. I'm still in awe of some of the artwork we get.
Where does that come from?
The beginning of all of that is after I've edited the basic articles. I send them off to our designer, and once he's had a chance to look over it, we sit down and have an art conference. Now, some editors are a little more hands-off than I am, but I do a layout sheet. I decide what page the article will be on, and then I divide off on that page where the illustration will be, and I usually have an idea. I'll describe the picture. Now, I'm not a dictator, even on my own magazine, but that's the jumping-off point.
In other words, you'll say something like, there should be someone standing at a doorway, and the other side of the doorway, it's dark. I mean, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely. Well, I might even get more particular. I'll describe, if it's about an assault on religious freedom, I might have, say, we need a painting, because a lot of it's original artwork.
Right.
We'll have, say, if it's an assault on the wall of separation of church and state, we'll have Jerry Falwell dressed in a medieval knight's outfit with a battering ram coming at the door of the castle, and inside might be the president or someone.
Yeah, okay.
And often that happens. Yeah. But I'm open, and we sit down with the designer and associate editor, and in the past there's been more people, but we're down pretty much to that. Mm-hmm. You know, if they come up with a better idea, wonderful. But it's amazing to me how often we end up going with what I've said. But yeah, it's one thing for me to have an idea. I can't draw it. I can't paint it, or much less even photograph it, which we do on occasion. So yeah, we look to the designer who knows the craft to choose the right artist based on samples and published work and so on. Then he preps them up on what we're trying to do with the painting. And I know there's a sample that he sends, but mm-hmm. It's an interesting process to see our vision become palpable reality.
Yeah.
And I wish it were a little different, but under copyright laws now, we can pay an artist quite a lot often to do an original piece of art specifically for an article, but we're only buying the rights, one-time rights, to use it in that magazine. We don't own that painting.
Yeah.
Usually by the nature of these pieces of art, they're not likely to appear anywhere else much, because they're very targeted toward the topic in that particular article. Mm-hmm. But we don't own them.
Hmm. When you start putting this together and you start seeing the proofs coming out, is it too late to make changes, or do you make changes even at that point? Do you say, well, that didn't work, or we need to move the picture over here?
You need to talk to the publisher. They probably have opinions on this.
Yeah.
No, but I've been edited for a long, long time, and the closer you get to the final product, it's very smart to minimize changes.
Yeah.
The only changes we should be making as we get, especially up to what the so-called, they used to be called blue line proofs, but now they're really just a color, very much like a laser printer. But at that stage, it costs a lot, relatively speaking, to change anything.
Yeah.
So we would only really want to change literal mistakes, a misspelling or a missed word or something.
Now, is all this done by computer? I mean, you're looking at proofs on the screen, or are they printed out? Are you looking at pictures?
Well, they still send us proofs.
They do. Okay.
You can look at it on the computer, and of course, we're originating the articles electronically and editing them there. But once we get a laid out page, we're still finding that it helps comprehension and visualization to have it printed out as a double page spread. There are many magazines and printers around the country that are doing it all on screen and hardly coming out with a hard copy. And then you can now go, which we don't quite do yet, but once that's cleared on screen, in many places it's then just a press of a button, and out the other end comes a printing plate.
Wow.
There used to be a whole department
houses
called, or printing places, called lithography.
Lithography, yeah.
But that's pretty much disappearing now. And then, of course, the press that we print on is a high-speed press, because we print nearly 200,000 copies of a 32-page paper. That's a lot of magazine. That's a lot of paper. The paper rushes through at something like 20 miles an hour.
I've seen that. I have visited the Review and Herald, and I've seen that press working at it. It is amazing how fast that thing goes. Oh,
And just setting it up, because when they first turn them on, there's a few minutes of tweaking and adjusting the color. the paper's spewing out the other end, and they have a whole almost a pallet load of debris.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
thankfully, they recycle all that. That's good.
They recycle it. It's sold as scrap paper.
Yeah, right.
You don't get much more than the cost of the paper, which is expensive.
Yeah.
But it's nothing like the cost of a finished magazine. Yeah. So once they get that done, and it used to be, for those that read Liberty magazine, it used to be glued and trimmed and done all in one motion. Mm-hmm. But lately, we've gotten a good deal where they now staple it.
Yeah.
And it gives it a nicer, more finished look, and it opens more nicely, where especially the center spread didn't open quite absolutely right when it was sort of glued together at the margins.
Now it lays flat. Now it lays
yes.
flat. When you look at that, Lincoln, you have been editor for a number of years, and you will take a moment and go over to the press sometimes and see that. How does it make you feel to see your magazine roaring through that machine at lickety-split speed, and you know that so many people are going to be reading that magazine? How does that make you feel personally?
Well, it makes me feel like I'm in the right job because that's the reason that I'm an editor.
Yeah.
I don't really like the nitty-gritty of working through an article. Well, I shouldn't say that. I like it because I'm used to it. But, yeah. I mean, that's not pleasant in itself. And there's many just busy things that we do. But the reason I'm an editor is to affect thinking. Mm-hmm. And it's very satisfying to me to see things that I've assembled that reflect my thoughts. I don't have to write the article for it to be an extension of my thinking.
Right.
Because I choose articles or assign articles based on a concept I'm trying to get across. Mm-hmm. So to see the product of my thinking...
Yeah.
And the planning on the artwork and so on. It's really, in total, it's an extension of me to see that churning out by the hundreds of thousands and going out. It's humbling, but it's also vindicating that here, I'm making a difference.
Mm-hmm. That's an important point to get forward to our listeners, because when you pick up a magazine, you're really picking up the thought processes of a pretty small group of people. Lincoln Steed is the editor of Liberty Magazine. When you look at Liberty Magazine, you're looking at an extension of Lincoln Steed's thought processes.
Right.
What you're looking at, you're not looking at just, he doesn't collect things and put them together and throw them out. No, he has a message that he wants to say. And I want to ask you, Lincoln, what is that message? And has that message changed since you came on board?
Well, the ultimate message is that religious liberty is God-given and central to every person being fulfilled in this life and in the life to come.
Yeah.
And coincidental with that, as I said in another program, it's something that if someone else doesn't have it, my use of it is threatened also.
Mm-hmm.
It's only really made active as it's broadly applied.
Mm-hmm. So you really can be subjective only to a certain point. Then you have to just realize these are the facts and we really can't change.
Oh, I'm not subjective about this. What I mean is I'm not dispassionate about this.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm biased, horribly biased on it. But what we try to be is intellectually honest.
Yes.
But we make no pretext of being neutral on the topic.
Yeah.
That's the one difference I have with my predecessor, Clifford Goldstein. I'm very good friends with him. But he was very inclined on many issues to put out two articles, a pro and a con. Well, they were both good articles, but I want the magazine to be seen to be pushing a certain way.
Yeah.
You read us and you know exactly where we stand.
And that's the beauty of it. We have too many, here's the good, here's the bad, here's the A and B, you decide. You're helping us see what is truth by your experience, by the experience of your writers, by what you have gone through and put together in your own heart. You're helping us see a cemented thought. And I like that about Liberty Magazine. When I read it, I can say, okay, that's good thinking. That's what I want to think right there. That's good thinking. I like that.
Now, I don't think we manipulate our readers.
No.
Nor even the authors. And they come from a wide variety of
backgrounds. But you set a standard. So many magazines don't set a standard. You set a standard for us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, I don't micromanage an author by any means. But I do, when I edit it, I look through and just every now and again something might be put in that's just way off the reservation, but not as much as you'd think, because they generally know what our position is.
Yeah.
And our position is not complicated. When we talk about church-state issues in the United States, the guiding rule is separation of church and state.
Yes.
We're avoiding entanglement.
Line.
We don't empower the state on spiritual matters. Once you apply that litmus test, even very complicated issues, it's easy to relate religious liberty to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about response. The magazine is printed. All the mechanics have taken place. The artist has done his or her work, and the photographers and the writers and the editor, and you've put it all together, and it's printed on those high-speed presses, and it's sent out. What kind of response are you getting on a regular basis concerning the magazine? Good, bad, what's going on?
Since it's an extension of me and others involved, but, you know, the buck stops with me, I guess, on the magazine. If someone criticizes it or sends in a letter attacking, I do tend to take it fairly personal.
Sure, sure.
And even on our Liberty board, you know, we've got a board that we sit down with before we publish each issue and run the stuff by. And they've challenged me a few times. You're very defensive on this. Well, I don't apologize for that because I bought into it. This I'm not just sort of a functionary bringing a pile of stuff in front of a group of people. No, this is me, and you challenge this, and I'm going to argue for it. I mean, obviously, if a group of people that we've got confidence in say this is probably not the best article, we would pull it. Yeah. But I can't really – well, once I can remember an article – that they didn't so much differ from what it said, but the person hadn't fully explained the issue, and we thought it was better to pull it and do it better later on. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it's not contentious in the sense that there's iffy stuff that I'm always sort of pushing past a group of my peers.
Yeah.
We do have a check process where we want others to buy into it. It would be dangerous, especially in a church context, if you had an editor who had a vision that was just totally out of sync with what the church stands for.
Yes.
And I can assure our listeners that the Seventh-day Adventist Church's position on religious liberty is long-term from the very beginning of the organization in the 1800s. And Liberty Magazine has not wavered on the basic presentation of that, and we will not change.
That's what I like about Liberty. In a sentence, that's what I like about it. It takes a stand. So, listener, if you pick up a copy of Liberty Magazine, you are going to find something concrete. You're going to find a point of view that has been built from understanding of history, a deep looking into the present, an eye toward the future. You're going to find a magazine that is taking a stand. And I commend you on that, Lincoln. That's a very good way of doing a magazine.
Thank you. And we do get a lot of letters from people, you know, not in huge numbers. We send out nearly 200,000. I'm not going to try to con anyone that we get like 10,000 letters a week. Uh-huh. In fact, I know that there's no magazine that gets that many. You always have to extrapolate from the letters we get. But we get regular feedback on occasion, and we print some of the letters that are negative. Mm-hmm. We have someone challenging a position. The only negative that someone doesn't like the magazine, now and then I'll get a request from a recipient saying they don't want the magazine anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the very small numbers, considering the nearly 200,000. But we get those. But they don't elaborate. And it might be they just don't want to read. Maybe they don't like religious liberty in general.
That's true.
But as far as people that call up, now and then they might take issue with a point raised in an article. And that's great. That tells me they're reading it. They, you know, just to read a heading and dismiss it is not an objection, but someone that's read it and analyzed it and they say, well, I see this a little different.
Mm-hmm.
We often print those letters. That's good. And it gives me a further chance. Often if those that read Liberty Magazine knows, I put an editorial note under the letters and explain myself a bit.
Yeah.
But we get many, many letters in the aggregate and regularly, even though not huge at any one time, letters from people saying they like Liberty Magazine. Mm-hmm. I've had a letter from a person that said they were secularist, didn't believe in religion, but absolutely believe in what Liberty Magazine is doing.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a letter from a man that said, I would never have said it, but he says, I'm a sodomite. He says, I know your magazine doesn't support my lifestyle, but he says, I love Liberty Magazine and I agree with what you're saying. It was very interesting because at that time, we were giving some cautions on where gay rights were leading, relating to religious liberty.
Mm-hmm.
I had a Seventh-day Adventist woman write in the other day saying, it was very interesting letter. She said she was a parole officer in a lower level court.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I saw this magazine in the judge's inbox the other day. She said, he's a Roman Catholic. And I figured this was was one of his church's magazines. And she says, and I picked it up, and it was fantastic. And she said, and then at the end, I see it's printed by my church, the Seventh-day Adventist. She says, wonderful. She says, keep sending it to that judge.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
So, you know, there's some interesting letters that come through. I get phone calls on occasion. I had a phone call from a mayor, I forget the name of the city, just slightly to the north of Atlanta. In my view, just one of the suburbs of Atlanta. But yeah. Went on and on for about 20 minutes. Wonderful Liberty was. He'd paid for it, I think he said, at some point to some of the top town officials. And he says, I believe in it, and you keep it up what you're doing, and so on. And, you know, that just warms an editor's heart to hear someone egging you on to do more.
Sure.
And I may have even quoted recently on this program, but I got a letter not that long ago from the Attorney General of Minnesota. And again, he says, I get many publications, but he says, I always read Liberty Magazine. He says, I believe what you're doing. He says, but don't ever go electronic. Stay with the paper version. We need it. And of course, that was just like gold. I could frame that one and put it on the wall. and yet we know that the electronic medium on the internet is replacing a lot of hard print. Yeah. But when you've got something you want to put in the hands of a specific target group, like the legislators and so on, I don't see how easily you could replace that with something online, because they might not go look at it. We want to know that it's come over their desk.
Yeah.
So there's really no substitute that I can see for a hard copy of Liberty Magazine, even though, as we often tell our listeners, we have it all available on the website. LibertyMagazine.org has the current issue with its graphics. It has archived articles back, I think, about 20 years now. And then other material, including our blog site and a little other information and even a few linkages to other religious liberty sites. So it's a good resource for those that are familiar with Liberty Magazine, but no substitute for either getting it yourself or helping subsidize for us sending it to one of these key thought leaders.
Yeah, right. And you can do that right there on www.libertymagazine.org.
We even can take your credit card number.
There you go.
It's not much. I go around promoting regularly, and I told someone the other day, I have an ice cream speech that you know, no one thinks twice about paying $5-6 for an ice cream. Mm-hmm. Nothing. It's just a casual thing. And here you can pay that much and get a magazine for a whole year. Well-researched, beautifully presented, top-quality paper. Obviously, money is not the issue. Some people think it is. But anybody that's convinced of what we're doing really can facilitate a lot of people to read it with a small amount of money. You know, think $100 or $200 put toward Liberty, not much money, and yet you're sending it out to a fistful of people.
That address again, www.libertymagazine.org. Check it out. Well, our time is gone. Lincoln, thank you so much for this behind-the-scenes look at Liberty Magazine. I love shows like this. And listener, until next time, this is Charles Mills along with Lincoln Steed saying, may you rest in the freedom of God's love. Goodbye, everyone. You've been listening to Life Quest Liberty. To further explore the issues discussed on today's program, visit www.libertymagazine.org. Join us again next week at this same time as we examine more of the threats and challenges facing your religious freedom. May God keep the flames of religious freedom burning in your heart today.